be needed. Then the other part of Pakal and Mai's, my paper, proposing some language for talking about this subject, was to say, okay, that's seven high. Let's break into seven equal pieces, triangles. 1 billion tons of carbon per year not emitted into the atmosphere 50 years from now as a result of some campaign, some strategy, some implementation project coordinated in some way involving some sets of countries. That's a wedge. Give it a name, a physical unit called a wedge. And the job of mitigating climate change is to find, to institute seven programs or programs that result in seven wedges. One program might result in two wedges. Those of you who heard Ernie Moniz's talk and saw the output of an MIT model in which in 2055 emissions were not seven but nine, I could work out that that particular model had two biofuels wedges and two carbon capture and storage wedges and one efficiency wedges, and there were five altogether. It's just a simple way to cut through what looked like a very murky story and have it about right and realize there were no nuclear wedges. And so what I will tell you is there are a lot of possible wedges, and they can do different things. A wedge, again, is this little green triangle, 25 billion tons, because that's the area times the height times the base times a half, 25 billion tons of carbon not emitted into the atmosphere. That's worth 6 parts per million by itself, each wedge, because a billion tons of because there are two numbers that are, that one is a physical identity. If you put 2 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere and all stays, the atmosphere concentration goes up by 1 part per million. Roughly half the CO2 stays. The oceans and the forests are pulling out the other half. So 4 billion tons of carbon to the atmosphere raises the concentration by 1 part per million. Each of these is worth 6 parts per million. If F7, it's worth about 40 parts per million. That's what you get in 50 years difference, approximately, from getting this job done. And if it were just getting the reductions in 50 years, that would be only, doesn't sound that big a deal. But what really happens is you're now at a much lower level to go forward into the future. And I'll go back one moment just for, that was what this curve was. Here are two ways in which you might move. And just to show you the kinds, it's really nothing, no different. It really is a simple flow and stock problem. And after 50 years, if you want to get to stabilization like 500 parts per million, I can remind you 560 is this famous doubling of pre-industrial, so 500 would be an interesting goal. You would have to reduce emissions after 50 years, for sure. You're not talking about keeping emissions constant. I want to make sure I've said that. 50 years constant and then down. On the other hand, if you're way up here, you can't go shooting down, probably, without enormous social dislocations. It has to do with how fast you can change things. No one knows how fast is too fast. But if we simply compare that trajectory with one in which you get up to some high level and then got to your, took carbon seriously, and in the same following 50 years did the same pair of things, you would end up about triple the pre-industrial concentration. So I sometimes say that the stabilization triangle is between beating doubling and avoiding tripling. Yeah.
How does reducing the level of emission drop it in the way you're suggesting? Because you don't get rid of the stuff that's already there. If you waited till the 50th year to go get rid of the stuff, you would already have more than you could ever get rid of, right? So.
Trying to understand, I must say I don't understand the question exactly, but there really, you say there is an assumption in this that we can neglect the carbon dioxide going away because it does stay for 100 years or more. Okay. So indeed, it's simply what you're putting in. Let's say you're putting in and immediately half is removed and the other half stays. It just stays forever.
So in this diagram where you've got...
Are you troubled with these numbers staying the same here?
The upper red line, how do you start dropping after
it's
this?
It's growing.
I'm sorry. It's being too fast. This is emissions and the red numbers are the concentrations. You need to really, you could have a second graph, but I'm putting it all on one.
Then you go from 750 down.
To 850. This emissions here gets you from 750 to 850. Okay? This emissions here got you from 470 to 500.
But the stabilization does ultimately require that there is a removal rate, even the long-term stuff, and yeah, there is.
There is.
And
so
this is based on carbon models that take account of that removal rate.
Right.
And relate in a quite complicated way,
right,
the emissions to the concentration.
Let me point out, again, probably worth getting this right, getting this clear. Very quick and dirty half stays. Earth is more complicated than that. And in particular, there are longer-term removal rates that keep operating, even if you're not emitting anything. And they help you a lot when you're down low. So you don't have to go all the way to zero to have stabilization, because when you put some stuff out, the oceans are pulling it out. But does that help you now to see that this is... on the same graph, I'm showing you the emissions curve and the answers to where you are with concentration. And behind this is a much more complicated model than 50% in, 50% out.
I wanted to allude to that. In the session yesterday with Dr. Holden and Dr. Lewis, afterwards I was asking Dr. Lewis about he was talking about tens of thousands of years, or thousands of years for the carbon. And he was saying that as the concentrations go up, the ability of the near oceans to absorb goes down, and that you get to a point where there's a decreasing ability of that, and therefore you have faster accumulations in the atmosphere.
Absolutely right. But with all respect to Lewis, Dr. Lewis, this is my attempt to say, if you're talking a 100-year problem, and you're talking about not going to very high concentrations, really all you need to know is that you're filling up a bathtub, the faucet, which you can run at higher or lower levels. There's a mechanism which takes half of what you're putting in, doesn't get to the bathtub at all, and you get the right answer approximately. You won't get this answer that I can keep the same emissions here because there's a long-term sink, which is another little hole in the bathtub, but it's a small hole compared to the one we're talking about. So hundreds of years, all kinds of other mechanisms. Uncertainties in the science, the reason I can get away with this is the science uncertainties are sufficient that this is good enough. Because the science, we can't pin it down. We don't, in particular, understand how the forests exchange CO2 with the atmosphere. And there's a lot of very interesting science debate on that subject. So good enough to get to the point where you guys understand what the problem is in social terms is to say half stays in, CO2 is there forever, we've got a certain amount we can put in altogether to reach, if we're going to stay below a certain level, we can do it now or later. All that is good enough to be right. And don't get confused with thousand-year problems, which are all there. Okay, so if we're going to try to deal with our carbon dioxide emissions, it's worthwhile knowing where they're coming from in this sense. This is data from the year 2000, so it's not 7, it was 6.2. And it's in 9 bins, two of which are zero. And it's gas, oil, and coal. And it's electricity, transport, and heating and other. Heating and other includes things like industrial uses. And the two biggest items are worth between them exactly half. Coal to power, and these are all global numbers. Coal to power and oil for transport. And then there are some medium-sized numbers, including gas producing a considerable amount of power, and this heating term, which includes gas for the gas heating networks and in industry, oil for petrochemicals, and coal in a number of sectors, including some very old-fashioned uses of coal in the poor country, in a country like China, distributed all over the place into villages. It's in there too. That's roughly what we've got to start with. So now we're going to say, how are we going to fill the stabilization triangle with 7 wedges by attacking various of these things on their way to doubling, on average, so that they don't? What can we do? So I'm going to give you 2 priorities and discuss each of them just a little bit. And this is what the Wedges paper explored, larger numbers of priorities and so on. First, there's a huge worldwide investment in long-lived capital stock that's underway at this time. It's a missing parenthesis over here. Making all new capital carbon smart is essential because fixing it up later is costly. If we really understand how urgent this problem is, we will be dealing soon and internationally and with a lot of U.S. leadership, U.S. business leadership, in getting going with what's being built today, buildings in tremendous urban conurbations, roads that will determine commuter patterns, power plants, ports, and saying what can we do that will affect the actual carbon use. energy efficiency and carbon efficiency be incorporated in all long-lived capital in all parts of the world. So examples. Wind, underway, a non-carbon power plant. If it's built in sufficient numbers, a coal plant will not be built. What's one wedge? A wedge, reminding you, is if we got that much going in 50 years and a coal plant wasn't built instead, you always have to say what wouldn't have happened. We would need 1 million 2-megawatt windmills on the planet that were there instead of coal. There's a wind advocacy. Where is wind policy? It has put wind into the position of the fastest moving renewable technology in the world, including in the United States. It's moving somewhat. It always could move faster. And we've got about 50,000 megawatts installed, if you like, since 2 megawatts is a typical windmill, about 25,000 of those, equivalent of those largest of the windmills today, actually going above that number now, but a very large amount of wind, 40 times more than we have right now, but we could do it. We absolutely could have a wind wedge in the picture. And that means the renewable community is very much in the game. Photovoltaics, likewise, but from a much smaller start. You need about 500 times what we are right now with photovoltaics to get the output.
With what?
With solar, what's sometimes called solar, these collectors that have these semiconductor materials on them that are by every highway telephone. Nuclear is in the same category from the point of view of the carbon problem alone. It's not easy to tell nuclear from renewables. They are the non-carbon fossil alternatives, primarily dealing with power. Biofuels, you might say, isn't, because it primarily deals with fuels, is somewhat different. So we have today on the planet 350 large power plants, the equivalent of them, and pretty nearly that number. Out of 700 not built instead of coal plants would be a wedge. Phasing out nuclear power worldwide by 2055 would be minus half a wedge. Tripling our nuclear fleet would be a wedge. Very controversial. Karl Rove is ready to roll with it, understands exactly how it fits into this particular policy landscape. We've got our hands full, I think, to make this work, because it's all about the international dimension of nuclear. These are not going to be built all in the United States, or most in the United States, or even half in the United States. Probably not a quarter in the United States. So we have a question of how we're going to do this, how we're going to organize the world to make this possible. Again, you had some time on this topic. The one that I think nobody dealt with much in the meeting, as I've been told, but everybody alluded to it and said we'll talk about it in the last talk, is carbon capture and storage, the very question you are asking. Can you burn, can you get power out and put the carbon dioxide back in the ground so it isn't one for one? This is a very interesting field. I'm personally very involved in it. I picked this particular picture to illustrate it because it is a USA, late 1990s, demonstration coal power plant in Wabash, Indiana, paid for by Department of Energy money, but still running on its own now. Where there is a technology being demonstrated called coal gasification. And that technology is on its way to being matched to the job of capturing carbon dioxide and taking it away from the plant. There's a gasifier right here, and then the gas goes to a gas turbine here, and the exhaust of the gas goes to a steam turbine there that was there for 50 years. So it's called a repowering project. Oxygen is used. This is an oxygen plant over here. With more processing of the gas before it got to the gas turbine, you could have CO2 that would then leave and go somewhere. Next slide. So the concept, there are other ways of capturing carbon dioxide, even with coal plants, than this one. This is the sort of very much on people's minds as the way to go. Strong competitors, every one of these fields, there's a favorite technology, there's somebody biting at its heels saying, we can do it too and keep us in the game. This is and I don't want to get into the details, but this is not the only way to go, but it was already on people's minds. It's the future of coal to a sufficient extent that this plant and the plant in Florida were built in parallel in the late 1990s by the DOE.
Is there a similar possible answers to why gasified coal is better for us than just using the coal?
Yes. No. It's that this gasified coal here, the gas, is at very high pressure, 80 times atmospheric pressure, 60, some number like that. If you remove the CO2 when it's at very high pressure, everything's compact, and the costs come down. It's an economic, not a physics argument. The costs come down compared to trying to pull the CO2 out of a stack when it's all dilute. So the competitor to this is pull the CO2 out of a stack, and this is pull the CO2 out right in here somewhere. The gas at that point is hydrogen.
Oh, right.
You turn this gas into a CO2 hydrogen mixture by some additional chemical processing. Then take the CO2 out and send the hydrogen there. And GE, Siemens, and Mitsubishi all have a hydrogen turbine to sell you at this point.
And in addition, the oxygen.
What about it? I'm sorry?
The air separation unit?
Yeah, oxygen is here. Yeah.
It's going to create nitrogen, CO2, and oxygen.
Well, the CO2 created here is negligible. The nitrogen is an interesting story. The oxygen is going into the gasifier. You don't want the nitrogen in the gasifier because then you have to separate it from the CO2 or send it to the turbine with nitrogen, and that's too much nitrogen. It wouldn't work as well. So it's probably. There are, of course, people arguing the other side of that, too. Probably you want an oxygen gasifier, which you already have at this particular place. Oxygen blown gasifier. The CO2, there is a CO2 little bit here. But
the bottom line is easy capture.
Bottom line is easy capture because the gasification allows you to capture pressure.
What do you do once it's captured?
Second time you've asked. Carbon storage. The subject has two halves. The subject has two communities of researchers with specialties, more chemical engineering in the first, more geology in the second. I went to a meeting in Norway, that's the biannual meeting of this community. It had 900 registered people, 130 from all over the world. The crowd, both groups are growing because governments in Europe and the United States are creating programs and projects. Where the CO2 can go is a really exciting and not fully understood problem, but the general idea is go below ground deep enough that it has become a very dense liquid-like material, density nearly water. Put it into below-ground porous formations, driving brine out in the process, that are located, because it's still more buoyant than water, that are located under a cap rock, a shale of some sort that doesn't let the gas through, and it will stay, unless there's a crack in the shale.
In which case
it will not stay. In which case there's another interesting, important fork. One is, it comes to the atmosphere slowly. The project is a waste of money. Somebody had an insurance policy, and the insurance pays the government back, or whoever back who you got money from to do the job that you turned out not to be able to do.
Nobody gets hurt.
Got one fork.
The atmosphere still gets hurt.
The atmosphere, you have to do more because it came up, right? So if we have 1 out of 50 failures like that in the first 10 years of this thing, I'm not going to be very concerned. In fact, I think it was probably a good sign that we're trying things that are a little hard. On the other hand, let me get the other fork, because the other fork is really important. If you get an abrupt release, you could get an accident that could kill people. And so there is on the one hand, the waste of money invested. Somewhat it's like Three Mile Island in Chernobyl. Three Mile Island was a horrible loss of an investment, complete loss of faith in an industry, no small matter, but nobody really getting hurt. The emissions were not outside the plant.
I know.
Fair enough. So this is just quickly that there is a project in Southern California with carbon capture and storage has been announced. Early this year, Schwarzenegger was beside some executives from BP and Southern California Edison as they just got a new name now as they announced this new project. It's going to start with petroleum coke, gasify it, turn it into hydrogen, CO2, send the hydrogen to a turbine, send the CO2 to Occidental's oil fields, where it can be actually have value rather than just being disposed of without value, increasing the oil production in those fields. So it's getting to that point where there are serious demos. BP estimates the cost of this is $1 billion. It's going to produce 500 megawatts of power into the California grid. The other broad category is efficient energy use. End use, we have to get there. We have to talk about that together because these supply strategies are interesting. They're technological marvels. They get lots of people excited. They do create new businesses, and they almost surely can't do the whole job. And on the demand side, post-industrial age features unprecedented private consumption, life, liberty, and the pursuit of comfort and mobility. And what is it about? 60% of our oil is used for transport. 60% of our electricity is used for buildings. In fact, so buildings, electricity use, a big factor. We're talking about power plants. But power plant is a building, to all intents and purposes. Power plant is a building. If we can reduce the energy in the building, we don't have to build a power plant. The building includes the appliances, of course, notably the appliances. I'll skip that one. I'll skip that one, too. Efficient use of fuel is the other half of the picture. I mean, since there's electricity, we've looked at those numbers of those skyscrapers before, 40% of the carbon in the goes to the atmosphere from power plants and 60% from other places where fuel is used directly, like tailpipes of cars, furnaces of homes. We can do it with car efficiency, and we can do it with changing the way we use transport, mass transport, telecommuting, two images to have in front of you. I'm going to skip the numbers to keep going. Because I asked myself a question for the Scientific American article. This is actually the first time I've talked about it in the group, because there's slides that we're preparing. It turns out that right now, that 7 billion tons of carbon per year, half are being used, well, if you like, not to where it came out of the ground, but where they're being used. Half are being used in the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Europe, the United States, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Mexico, you know, basically the industrialized countries. Half, almost exactly half. And half in the rest of the world. Okay. What should be in our heads the fraction emitted 50 years from now if we don't take carbon seriously? There are, again, 100 different answers. Pick the number. 60% more than today in the developed world. That leaves more room for the developing world. An image of what, if we don't have to worry about carbon, it might look like. We would use less than half of what's out there to use in the next 50 years, the increment going into the next 50 years. Again, just as a picture of the stuff. What's now 50-50 would be 60-40. Alternatively, let's split the other way, split the other problem. Here it is with the goal, this interim goal, which the environmentalists say isn't strong enough, and we have to split. And again, I'm making up this number. You make up a different one, please. And I said, well, I picked Tony Blair's number. I had to find something. Tony Blair says England will reduce its emissions by 60% 50 years from now. He picked the reference year, which was earlier. And if we said the whole OECD does that, well, then we're down to 20% of the emissions of the whole. And the OECD has, and the non-OECD has grown. But the maximum it could have grown would have been to double its emissions in 50 years, and it was more than doubling its emissions in the earlier one. And we've got to emit something. You've got to put this arrow somewhere. The angle of this arrow is yours to choose. If we put it here, the OECD as a whole is emitting 60%, 40% of what it's emitting right now. And before it was emitting 1.6 times. So it's down by a factor of 4 from this exercise. But that looked like this light challenge to keep the emissions constant for the world is a factor of 4 challenge to the OECD. Should the United States be exempt from that target? Should we treat it a little bit more nicely? We're the one with a growing population. Maybe we should have a little extra room than all the way down to 40%, but that means other countries will go down to below 40%. This, I think, has to be better understood. And the fact that it's 50-50 right now makes it relatively easy to understand how to think about this problem. So here's the industrialized world going down to 40% of its current emissions in 50 years, and the non-industrialized world going up to 160%, while its population is growing to about 130%. So it's a little bit of room for per capita carbon emissions in the developing world. So we have both parts of the world working very hard. I'm going to skip that one. So somebody has done, Dan Lashoff at NRDC, a wonderful guy at a wonderful organization, took this wedges stuff and said, let me work it out for the United States. And this is your first look at what the actual revision was for our Scientific American article. And here we are with the U.S., 1.6 out of 7, just under a quarter right now, heading down to about 60% or up to 60%. And the wedges, which are energy efficiency, passenger, 4 kinds of efficiency, doing most of the job, but very important message that that's what they say. No nuclear because it's NRDC. Renewables and carbon capture and storage. Okay? But I want to say this is anybody can play this game. There is nothing hard here. Once you get these modelers out of your way and just say, okay, here's the problem. And then we can all participate. I want to show this one slide because there is a tremendous confusion about what the deep poverty has to do with all of this. There are 2 billion people or so who are truly without any access to the modern world. They're in remote villages. They do not have electricity or in the slums of cities, still burning some very low-grade fuel for cooking. And I just asked, suppose we give all of them what the World Bank calls some kind of sufficiency. It's lousy, but it's actually gave them more than the number they chose. The numbers are at the bottom here. And then suppose we do that in the next 25 years, get the job done linearly, versus waiting 25 years and then getting the job done. This is the extra increment that you get out of that job. In other words, the poor use so little energy that giving them the kind that gets them to be called basic human needs have been dealt with. The equivalent of saying there's a fourth grade, there's an education for women, there's clean water, there's inoculations. That set of issues that are the millennium issues do not impact global carbon. The oil markets are anything at a global level. It's about middle class consumption. It's about the growth of a very large number of people who want more stuff, not about the people who have nothing whom you give a little to. And that is totally messed up in the minds of so many people right now. And if you want, think of a country like China as a billion, 700-800 million people who are going to be dealt with like this way, and 500 million who are in the middle class already, if those are the right numbers, something like that. India, something like that. Two last slides. So, message. Cutting global CO2 emissions will require major changes in the post-industrial social envelope. Put that phrase forward. Maybe it's useful. We look at what are we doing that we don't want to do. Commuting is one of the things I think we mostly don't want to do. Can we do things that with the property tax system that will reinvigorate cities and discourage sprawl? It's that level of change that we've got to be talking about as climate relevant. It will also require some change in the preferences and the concept of the good life. Over the next 50 years, can human beings learn to share the planet? To me, that is the deep question we've faced with. And in some sense, our location in environmental history, it's a very special place. We're just about to get into a period of enormous change. I like this drawing, maybe none of the rest of you do. That we're at the edge of doing something very different, which is not crash, but it's not continuation. Regina, take it from there.
All right. Thank you, Rob. My topic is adaptation, and clearly this will have to be much more impressionistic because the science is more nascent and the answers are less clear-cut. Rob can tell you exactly how to get to any goal that you might set. In order to do that for adaptation, we'd like to know what the impacts are that we want to avoid, and we actually have only a very dim picture of what the impacts of climate change are going to be.
And Regina, are you wearing one of these, or do I have to pass this to you?
No, I'm on. I think I'm on. Yeah. So we don't really understand the impacts of climate change, and that makes it very difficult to understand how to cope with them. However, the change is underway now, and it's likely to accelerate, and so timing is of the essence. And what that suggests is that maybe in order to adapt, what we need to do is kind of hedge our bets, and in some cases actually plan for increasing uncertainty because we don't know exactly where or when there are going to be more floods and more droughts, but we know there will be both, and we don't know exactly where and when and how much climate will change. So we might need to adapt by building in additional flexibility to climate change. So what I'm going to do is try to talk about some strategies that I think we need to think about for adaptation rather than try to give you the answers of how to get to a particular endpoint. But the first thing I want to say is that in terms of thinking about impacts, I really think you have to think about climate change as a matter of degrees. But I mean degrees in three ways. We spend a lot of time thinking about it in terms of temperature. But I think these two other ways are perhaps more important and less well studied. And here, by the middle panel, I mean thinking about climate change in terms of the degrees or the amalgamation of impacts that climate change and other environmental stresses add up to, so that as you try to solve one problem, you don't exacerbate or create another. And the third, I mean degrees in terms of latitude and longitude, because where you live on the planet determines greatly how the climate change impacts will feel to you and what your adaptive capacity will be. So let me just give you one example of each of these. Clearly, the degrees in terms of temperature matter a great deal. Whether we continue on this business as usual path that Rob laid out for us, which would lead to warming temperatures of some 15 to 25 degrees Fahrenheit, more than today, at a 4x CO2 world, or whether we could stop at that 2x CO2 world, which would still lead to a temperature increase of some 2 to 3 degrees centigrade, or roughly 4 to 6 Fahrenheit, which many of the scientists over the course of this conference have already begun to call that dangerous. But either of those globes are of worry to ecologists because they represent pushing temperature change roughly 4 to 10 times as fast as we've seen in the last 10,000 years. And in the last 10,000 years, humanity has essentially flowered. So we're moving outside of human ken with the rates of change represented by either of these worlds. The other thing that's worrisome to ecologists is to the extent that we've studied what the impacts of climate change might be, we've tended to focus on what might happen in a 2x CO2 world. And yet this is the business as usual path. So we really don't have a good handle on the impacts of climate change. The second kind of degrees that I mentioned was the amalgam or the composite of interactions across environmental issues. And so I just lay out some of them for you here. But clearly, climate change interacts with all of these. And let's just pick forestry for an example. So forests hold carbon. And when forests burn, they release carbon. And if things are drying out, that may lead to more forest fires. But carbon dioxide is also a fertilizer, so it might help the forest grow faster. So you have these huge swaths of uncertainty. And there's a group called the Greening Earth Society that actually says, well, you know, in general, the world is going to get warmer and wetter, and a warmer, wetter world should be greener. And maybe that's true, but what if it all turns out to be kudzu or noxious weeds? And this is not completely improbable. The best guesses are that the range for kudzu will, of course, move north and west as climate changes. And you've seen some recent studies that talk about how ragweed pollen will triple as carbon dioxide doubles and poison ivy becomes more pesty and the compounds more prevalent. So warmer, wetter, greener, how this actually plays out, not completely clear. And we need to understand the interactions of these things in time and space by sector. So again, as we try to solve problems related to agriculture, forestry, air quality, water, we understand what we're doing. My third kind of degrees was latitude and longitude. And although much of the U.S. has been in drought many of the last few years, it's very clear that droughts impact us in a different way than this drought of 2003 impacts the folks in India. The human pain and suffering is very much linked to your ability and your capacity to adapt. And in general, the developing countries are expected to be both more vulnerable and less adaptable to climate change, in part because they have less access to financial resources and technology, perhaps institutional capacity to cope, but also because a larger portion of their economies tend to be related to climate-sensitive sections such as agriculture. So what do we expect the impacts of climate change to be, despite all the uncertainties? Well, we expect that as the temperature increases, the rainfall will increase as you speed up the water cycle, sea level will rise, and the display of pictures across the top, the different sectors, will all be impacted. So you'll expect that there will be different ideal ranges for the crops and for forests. Water will be affected in terms of timing, quantity, quality. Coastal infrastructure may be inundated by sea level rise. Ecosystems will be trying to move with this incredible pace of change of temperature, with the different parts migrating at the speeds they can crawl or fly. Infectious disease may spread, and heat waves may be a problem. Certainly, there will be a change in amenities as the temperature and humidity and lifestyles of our community will change with a changing climate. With the summers in Michigan becoming more like summers in Oklahoma, that's a very different lifestyle for our community. Energy will be affected by climate change too, and we saw how the hurricane disrupted oil and gas supplies, but low levels of water can certainly affect hydro, can affect the cooling water for nuclear power plants, affected in the Mississippi drought of 88, whether you could actually get the coal to the power plants. So that will also be impacted, and the flows of materials and trade and food will be affected as wealth and regional resources are redistributed as climate changes. We're already seeing lots of changes. Each of these spots on the globe represents a change in something, in sea ice, in plants and animals moving either northward, as you'd expect, or altitudinally upward. And all of these are consistent with what you would expect as climate changes. We're also seeing an increase in droughts, twice the amount of the Earth's surface is in droughts compared to 30 years ago. We're seeing an increase in floods. And you've heard quite a bit at this conference about the increased melting of mountain glaciers and of Greenland. So what do you do to cope? Well, adaptation options can include a variety of things. And this is not inclusive, but this is examples. So you can try to manage your way out of it. You can come up with technological fixes. You can do infrastructural fixes. You can create new institutions. You can improve your monitoring. You can do R&D to develop new solutions. And so just some examples of each of these. If you're thinking land use planning, if you think about things on bigger spatial and temporal scales, maybe bigger ecosystem units are more likely to stay intact as climate changes. If you can link reservoirs, you can perhaps enhance water supply. Dams and dikes can hold back the sea level. If you're worried about losing genetic diversity, you might be able to do things with seed banks or propagation techniques. For floods, hurricanes, disease spread, you might want to have faster emergency response systems, better early warning and surveillance systems. You might want to discourage people from doing risky things as climate changes by creating incentives or disincentives or insurance. You might want to talk about what lands really will persist. If you're going to preserve some areas, you might not choose the wetlands that are going to be inundated as sea level rises. And things like designing migration corridors for species to move would be an important R&D effort that really is not well understood or well known. That was interesting. That must be my nephew. Adaptation. He wants to put sounds in my PowerPoint, crashing glass and things. But anyway, so adaptation could actually increase our resilience to change. People talk about reactive adaptation or anticipatory adaptation. I actually think we need both because we're reacting to the change that's going on now, but we're anticipating even greater change. But not all systems that are sensitive to climate change need be vulnerable to climate change. So let me give you one example. Think of agriculture, clearly sensitive to climate. But you know, we plant the crops every year, and so we should be able to keep up with the changing climate as long as the information flow and the seed banks are available. Regions will have to develop the capacity to cope with changes in all sectors at the same time. So your water is changing, your agriculture land is changing, your forests are changing. And so a region will have to think about that composite. But if you can think of ways to increase your resiliency, you can reduce risks and take advantage of opportunities. And preparing for climate change is very consistent with things like smart growth, sustainable development, and the long-term planning horizon, such as what states and cities really need. This is a picture of reactive adaptation during a flood. This is the poor pig that climbed on the top of the file cabinets. I would suggest that might not be optimum, but a much less humorous example, of course, that was very recently on our mind is the reactive attempt to adapt to New Orleans hurricane in 2005, and actually it's not clear that that is, in fact, adaptation because the coping and response strategies are far from complete in dealing with Katrina. So what I want to do now is turn to four strategic classes of adaptation needs that I think we need to develop as we think about preparing for climate change. So the first is to think about multiple stresses in concert with climate change on systems and to try to fix those problems. The second is to think about the right scale to address the problem, whether it be regional or watershed. The third is to do a much better job dealing with extreme events and their consequences. Those cause human pain and suffering. They happen now. We don't deal with them well. They're going to happen increasingly as climate changes. And the last is to conduct iterative assessment and synthesis. So let me start first with multiple stresses. I just show you, just pay attention to the two sets of the eastern U.S. that you can see. Upper left shows you ozone concentration in parts per million with the 1990 climate and 1990 emissions. You see some modest orange and red smearing in the 70 to 80 parts per billion one-hour ozone. But by the 2050s, with 2050 emissions, which should be decreasing, but the 2050 temperature, which helps to cook the smog, you can see a much greater swath of red, which is approaching the dangerous health areas for ozone. And clearly, if we don't think about this now and just head on trying to meet the air quality standards, we will not necessarily meet health air quality standards. Another example is climate change in the Mississippi River. And, of course, the 20-state region that drains into the Mississippi, mainly the nitrogen fertilizer runoff, leads to a huge hypoxic zone, sometimes called the Dead New Jersey because it's about the size of New Jersey, not any other pejorative reason. And if we... I had to put that there for you, Rob. But so if you look at this bottom row, if you reduce nitrate runoff by 30%, green is good. You would reduce the size of the hypoxic zone 37%. If at the top you could reduce river discharge by 30%, less water bringing less nutrients, nitrate down the river, you could get a huge decrease in the size. But remember, we expect it to be a warmer, wetter world. So if you increase river discharge 20%, you completely negate what you've done by reducing the nitrate. If you increase the water temperature, you get a bigger hypoxic zone. And if you get what we expect as climate change is both a 20% increase in river discharge and perhaps 4-degree water, you increase the size of the hypoxic zone from 63%. Again, if we were to enact a 30% nitrate concentration decrease, which is no mean feat, we would not accomplish what we need to do in reducing the hypoxic zone. One very near and dear to my heart is the preservation of biodiversity. And these red areas in the world are hotspots of biodiversity. And you may know we're spending a tremendous amount of money to try to preserve these hotspots of biodiversity. Well, now keep that picture in mind and let me show you the parts of the world that are expected to change ecosystem type as climate goes through a 3-degree centigrade, roughly 6-degree Fahrenheit, the unbaked world picture. All these parts of the world are expected to change ecosystem type, and some will actually improve and become more productive, and some will be degraded, and some will disappear completely, like the tundra, the beautiful alpine meadows here. But nonetheless, if we don't think about whether the areas of biodiversity we're trying to preserve can actually persist as climate changes, we may be wasting enormous amounts of money and also be completely inefficient in preserving the world's biodiversity. The second adaptation need is pick the right scale and think about what you can do at that level. So for all different parts of the country, climate change will manifest itself differently. These are some of the key things you would worry about depending on where you are in the country. And let's look in very fine detail. This is a picture of Bethany Beach, and it's eroding. And so in 65 years, the erosion, each of these dots is kind of a block. So the erosion will move back, will take away 65 feet of waterfront. But this is without sea level rise. And so sea level rise will take it back to here over the same period of time. So if you don't think about climate change overlaid with simple erosion problems in a place like Bethany Beach, again, very expensive infrastructure losses. You think about population growth in the last, this is just the last decade, the darker green, the higher growth rates. And you can see it was Nevada, Arizona, Idaho, Utah, and Colorado, and Georgia for some reason, that have been growing the most. and then you look at what California expects, that its water use is going to increase 40% over the next 25 years. There's going to be a real squeeze for water. And you overlay, so this part of the world that's growing on the left, with this picture of what snowmelt's going to look like in the next several decades, where the big red circles are 25 to 35 days earlier snowmelt, another month earlier snowmelt in all these regions that need water. And you can see we're on a collision course. Clearly, you have to think about water allocation systems, the timing, the storage, the transfer, and the pricing, or you will not be able to cope with the water needs and the water availability of the future. or Florida, which I think I showed in the water session we did earlier this week. The red area is the part expected to be underwater with a 1 meter sea level rise. This is a third of the Everglades. We're paying $8 billion to replumb the Everglades right now. And if you look along the coast, all these little dots of red, yellow, and blue are high, medium, and low surface water intakes that supply city water and will likely be underwater with that 1 meter sea level rise. So certainly we have to think about a way to provide water to Florida to deal with too much water and to deal with the ecology of the Everglades, but right now that's not happening. The same sea level rise for Bangladesh would be impossible to deal with. This would take out 13 million people and would create an enormous international problem. You can't adapt to this. This would require relocation. It requires our UN agencies to be thinking about how the influx of environmental refugees on this scale can actually be dealt with. This requires very different institutional approaches than we have today. The third area, prepare for extreme events and their consequences. Well, as I said, we don't really handle them very well, and we expect droughts and floods and more intense hurricanes tomorrow. And so if we can develop better means to both anticipate and cope with extreme events today, we will be building an adaptive capacity for tomorrow. This is just the picture of the Mississippi in the incredible drought year where they couldn't get the coal or the hydro or the nuclear to work, and then in the flood year. And you can see, and you can remember how difficult life was in both of those situations. And the drought year is one where mitigation and adaptation really come together because of the inability to supply energy. This is a picture of another kind of extreme event, historic forest fires in boreal areas, and forest fires expected under a doubled CO2 world, again, that non-roasted world. And this model actually appeared when Frank Loy and I were in The Hague talking about what the terrestrial carbon sinks should be and how we should count them and all that. And the Canadians actually said, well, if the forests go up in smoke, could that be considered an act of God and maybe that carbon wouldn't need to be replaced, knowing that, of course, we expect forest fires to increase? Well, obviously, that wouldn't help the atmosphere to give an out for an act of God. But a very serious concern as we think about storing carbon in forests, growing forests as a mitigation measure, the ability of those forests to actually persist is very important. And so thinking about forest management, fire management in concert with climate change, increasingly important. And there was a paper just released this week in Science that talked about the forest fires here in the West being linked to the increase in temperature and to a change in climate. So this will become a more serious issue. Since we're in the middle of the hurricane season, I have to just say a word about hurricanes. This is Africa, and there is the south coast of the U.S., and the box is the hurricane formation region of the ocean. And the temperatures, the 2, 3, and 4 degree range are the shades of orange. And that's Celsius, so roughly double that for Fahrenheit. The temperature of the ocean in the prime hurricane forming regions is up to 7 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than normal. And it's been so for the last 3 years. And if a hurricane forms, and they usually come rolling off of Africa across the ocean, if it forms over warmer water, it will intensify the hurricanes. There have been a spate of new papers that have talked about this and how it's been changing in the last 30 years, and they're becoming more intense. And of course, again, Katrina brings that home to us very powerfully.
What was that 7% figure that you mentioned? I didn't catch that a moment ago.
7 degrees.
7 degrees. So this is in Celsius. So the temperature of in that box is running between, 1 and 5 degrees Celsius higher than normal. And so it's roughly double that to turn into Fahrenheit.
The increase is 7% over the last 3 years? Or
did I say 7%?
No, 7 degrees.
7 degrees. So for the last 3 years, the ocean temperatures have been about 7 degrees higher than the historic average. And we know the oceans are warming. There's some 5 million data points that people have studied. But this particular band of warm water is what fuels hurricanes. And so my last area is conduct iterative assessment and synthesis. And there's probably as many definitions in this room of what an assessment is as there are people. But to me, it means that you stop every once in a while and you take stock of all that you know about science and planning and management, and mitigation options, and you try to put it together into a picture to guide near-term actions, to define a research plan so that you have answers in the coming years when you need them. And the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, an international consensus science body. Every 5 years, the scientists of the world do it, 2,000 scientists, 150 countries, and they come up with, you know, bottom-line statements, negotiated text, painful but powerful. And this is a picture of the National Assessment of the Impacts of Climate Change on the U.S., mandated by the Congress, the Global Change Act of 1990. And Neil Lane, who was here earlier, but I don't think he's here now, and I helped complete the first one in the year 2000. And this did a very interesting thing in that it looked at 22 regions of the country, and it looked at five sectors, and it tried to look in both slices at what climate change might mean for the U.S. and to very early begin to think about ways that we might cope with it. To give you an example of some of the things that emanated from this one, the group in the Pacific Northwest clearly saw that water was going to be a problem. And so the city planners, the hydro planners, and those who deal with the salmon and in-stream fisheries needs are now actually running a whole series of models to see just how many people, fish, and timing of hydro they can support. In New York, Manhattan realized that the subways and LaGuardia will be underwater by the end of the next century, with many of the storm surges at the end of this century. But that's right, we are in 2006. That the storm surges expected with a 3-foot sea level rise will actually inundate a lot of infrastructure in Manhattan and potentially make replenishment of Fire Island beaches too expensive to do. And they're sitting down now and trying to figure out if there are infrastructural ways to gird the subways. Well, I don't know. You know, I've actually only seen, I suspect that's not good either. It's pretty low-lying stuff there. But they actually did the replenishment of Fire Island. By now, they might have done more. It's NASA Goddard folks. I could see if they've gotten further with that modeling.
Good for Aspen.
Well, maybe. Yes, could be. Well, it depends what good is. That's what I was going to say, yeah. And one of the most exciting things that actually emanated from thinking about heat stress in cities and climate change is in this area of public health after the Chicago events of several years ago, I guess maybe about 10 now, where some 700 people died when we had this pattern of very hot nights. It just didn't cool off. And so now 200 cities in the U.S. are developing these extreme weather operation plans so that it's geared to the climatology of your city, and when and it gets activated when climate conditions begin to suggest that life-threatening heat waves are coming. And so I think that was one very positive sort of beginning of adaptation options that emanated from that first national assessment. The thing that really worries me, though, is the next national assessment is not going to be done in a way that kind of integrates regions and sectors and brings it all up to the whole. It's being done in kind of 21 little questions that are slices taken care of by different agencies. So I'm not sure that that is going to actually give us, again, a comprehensive picture of our state of knowledge and some ideas on adaptation. So I wanted to end by saying adaptation can't solve the problem. We know ecosystems are unlikely to be able to adapt to either the slowed changing world that Rob suggested at 500 parts per million, certainly not at the business as usual pace we're headed. We're hardly doing any research on adaptation. We spend $2 billion a year on climate research. We actually spend $2 billion a year on energy research, too. But we spend about $20 million a year in adaptation research. We spend about $20 million a year on renewables research. The costs will really increase as climate change increases, so mitigation is very important. And there may be tipping points that occur even at the 2 degrees C or roughly 4 degrees Fahrenheit, which was the unbaked world that I show you and could be considered dangerous. One example of this is the drought that occurred in the Southwest a couple of years ago was very similar to your droughts of record. It was 1 degree warmer, though. and it killed 12,000 square kilometers of pinyon pine. And so the increase in temperature with a drought of record can actually create things like a tipping point. So let me finally stop and just say the challenge is sustainable management of our ever-changing planet. We need both mitigation and adaptation. And according to the organizers, we are actually allowed to continue talking for 20 more minutes. So if you're up for it, we can take some questions.
Rosina, if you said there was only $70 million in adaptation research.
20.
Or something like that. If you had another $70 million, where do you think, especially in the ecological adaptation issues, as opposed to the societal one, where would you put it? What kind of stuff is not being done?
Well, I actually would put a lot of it into the regional analysis so that I wouldn't, I think to the extent we have done work, we've done it like forests, we've done agriculture, we've done water, and it really is all of those things happening in a place that I think is most problematic. I think the first national assessment helped people think about getting different sectors to talk to each other and talk about how water moves from one to the other, or fertilizer needs, or land use for biomass, or for forests, or for crops. So I actually would put, I don't know, several million dollars into competitively awarded regional assessments of the impacts of climate change, and then conduct where we really didn't get to these kind of what-if scenarios. How could you cope with it? Are there things you could do around that? But there's so many devil in the details of the ecological impacts that we really haven't studied yet. For example, shifts in pests. So, you know, and I can show you maps that say the if the crops can be grown in the right temperature and precip regimes, we'll have enough food for the world. Well, nobody deals with exactly what's going to happen to the pests. In the warmer, wetter world, you know, expect they could overwinter. I mean, we've seen things like in the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska, where the overwintering spruce bark beetles just, you know, chomped right through that stuff, and now there's a huge dead area again, you know, sort of a cliff. So there's lots of details under the individual sectors, and I guess I would say I think pests of all kinds, whether it be infectious diseases or for crops and forests, are one of the really big underattended ones, and whether that will actually lead to tipping points.
I realize that that this thing's very regional and that the impact here will be different from there. But having said that, two broad themes that weave through all this is droughts and warmer weather. Can you help us understand
why
how droughts reconcile with warmer weather?
Well, I mean, basically, you're warming up the planet, so you're increasing evaporation, so you are increasing drought potential, but you're putting more water into the atmosphere, and most of the evaporation happens over the oceans, just huge amounts of water going up into the atmosphere, and it'll come down somewhere as rain or as snow, but some areas the soils are actually drying out more, and some places are getting wetter, too. So that's the paradox, is you're speeding up everything. And so it's both drier in some areas and wetter in others. And the models tend to project that the interior of continents will become drier, and especially seasonally. So those two globes I showed you of the U.S., the not baked and the baked, the soil moisture in the summer would be decreased by some 30% to 60%. And, of course, that's the growing season. So if you'd say global average wetter is the answer, but there will be, you know, drier areas, wetter areas, and then seasonal differences. So it can be both.
John?
Yeah, this is a question for Rob, I think, mainly. The wedge model is a wonderfully clear and compelling way to look at the fossil fuel CO2 part of the problem. But there are some other parts of the problem, as you know. There is CO2 coming from deforestation in the tropics, best estimate for which is usually cited in the range of 1.5 billion tons a year, but it could be 2.5 billion lately because of the drying out of the tropics and the burning that is taking place in the humid tropics that never took place before because they were too wet to burn. And then there's the methane and there's the black soot. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you folks in your Princeton group have looked for wedges in these other domains. Have you started to...
The answer is yes, we've started to, and it's been fun to write that very early paper and then to say how many places it branches out. The flow of carbon between the biosphere and the atmosphere is 10 times larger than the human extraction of carbon from below ground to the atmosphere. But it's a two-way flow. And so there is imposed, one slide I could show you is the year-by-year fluctuations and how much the natural system puts from the ground into the atmosphere minus what it sends back. It's not zero on any given year. It bounces around a little bit. And it creates noise in the system of actually figuring out how much change you've got. So whenever we make changes in the natural flows of the biosphere, we change the carbon system too. It's a very important thing to add that John is encouraging. The deforestation rate, the deliberate cutting of trees, some of the second-order consequences like the drying out of peat and other things of that sort. We have a whole second front, if you like, dealing with the biological carbon. Some of that can help. No-till agriculture, or as we were hearing from Vinod Khosla yesterday, some of the biocrops can actually put carbon into the soil. It builds up as reduced carbon. There are strategies that play, in our view, actually two of our initial wedges were one related to forestry and one related to soil carbon. And there are more. Then the next one is there are other gases that do the same thing in the atmosphere as CO2 does. And by far the most important of those is methane. And methane is responsible for about a half as much of the warming as the CO2 is. There were a period of time when some of the climate scientists say, look, carbon dioxide's too hard. Let's go after methane first, a few years of that. The problem is we don't understand the methane cycle in detail. We know that it's coming, this is natural systems, many of them man-engineered natural systems, irrigation, rice paddies, cattle are the source probably of most of the additional methane, which is building up in the atmosphere in concentration, much like CO2, but nowhere near the same handle on it. Can we change cattle feed? Can we change rice paddy management in some fashion, or timing in some fashion or another? Another frontier, I would call it a third frontier. It's not all what we talked about today, so those are friendly amendments. I can't go much further than that. I'm going to have a student working on methane, learn a little bit more, but I know it's terra incognita in some of that. Yeah?
Professor Sokolo, with regard to carbon capture sequestration, is there or what is being done as far as the possible problems of leakage? Is there a way of flooding leaks, monitoring when it's submersed?
A lot of work, but I think one of the things we agreed, some of us in the conversation, I think wasn't inside one of the talks, but right at the edge of it, was although the work is very substantial right now, it isn't big enough. We need many more experiments. But the geologists are asking how well can they define a porous formation, what kinds of pressures are put on that formation as the CO2 is injected, can you create a crack that wasn't there before? When you go to places which had oil and gas, you're kind of thinking that there's a pretty good volume there that is capped from escape because it was there for hundreds of millions of years. But is that always going to be true? It's going to be a situation where there will be, in terms of certainty of integrity of the place, a lot of variation. And you'll start with some of the better places, but I would argue you should try some of the places where you're not so sure, so you learn about them. And in kind of a permissive permitting regime. Do you want a really rigid permitting regime and no errors? Or permissive permitting regime. There's a design question there. What I worry about is repeating the nuclear waste disposal story. I went into this, and about 5 years ago, I said to people, I'm going to understand how nuclear waste went awry by learning about this problem. And I got some of the clues that I was looking for. Bureaucrats who said, do not mention leakage, will not get our funding in Congress for the carbon capture and storage program. Can't leak. Business people who would say in a public meeting with environmentalists, I know carbon doesn't leak, carbon dioxide doesn't leak, and my job is to persuade you that it doesn't. No. You're not. You know that carbon could leak. You can work harder than any of the rest of us to figure out how it could. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll get it. So we've got stuff that resembles the nuclear problem in terms of public acceptance is not there. Carbon dioxide is not dangerous in slow leaks the way small leaks of isotopes would have more reason, I think, to get people frightened. But it does have a hazard. Can we afford to have one of the first 10 projects have a serious accident? I don't think so. But it's open territory. And technically, I should include one major issue that otherwise people say didn't say it at all. Where we might, there's a lot of appeal to putting the CO2 in the places where the oil industry is now active, because it can help scrub old oil fields and bring more CO2 to the ground, to the surface. So people pay for CO2 that arrives at the boundary of an oil field, actually quite a bit, enough to make a market pull for this whole technology. However, where there are oil fields, there is a large number of wells. There are over 1 million wells in Texas. There's over 100,000 in Alberta. And we've been doing some studying, modeling in Alberta scene. If you put CO2 below ground in a well that you've either dug or you've commandeered, and it's going to move horizontally below ground, there may be another well, which you might even not know about if it's a 1920 well that people sealed up with throwing some rocks in and then some fill. And it could find itself a new channel to come to the top. How this subject is actually part of the licensing of deep underground storage of ordinary chemical waste, which is a program of the United States. And they have to, in getting a permit, demonstrate that they know where the old wells are. So it's going to be the leakage through a second well. What happens if the CO2 encounters the cement? It's a research program we're actually doing at Princeton. Yeah.
Two questions. What kind of pressure is this stuff under? And what would be a sort of catastrophic accident rather than just a slow leak? What would be a description of such an accident?
I think I understand that. I think I understand this. But but check it out with people who know more than I do. People are now asking, can you have a substantial fast leak when it's in a porous formation? It's in the formation at essentially the pressure of the formation. Now you connect it to the ground. And it's in liquid form. It's liquid CO2. Some of it's in solution, but think of liquid CO2, which is, there's a cap rock, there's a layer of phase CO2 in some porous rock, and then there's a CO2 water boundary, just the way there's an oil CO2 boundary in an oil field. And so it could come out. Probably can't come out of a porous formation fast enough to give you a fast leak. The thing you have to worry about is a two-step process where it moves to a cavity of some kind where it's not any longer in a porous formation. And then some event creates a fast release. And here's the awful natural accident that happened in Cameroons, 1984, I think. CO2 is under, is in, there's a lake called Lake, think of it a second, Nyos. There's a Lake Nyos in the Cameroons in the mountains in a volcanic region. There's a volcano underneath. The CO2 is being exhausted from that volcano to the bottom of the lake where it builds up under the water in solution, but the cold water holds a lot. And there was an event in 1984. People are not even sure what it was. Could have been a rock slide on the side, but it turned the lake over, and the water was warmer at the top. It doesn't hold as much CO2. There was a major escape of tens of thousands of tons of CO2 in a few hours, which then, because it's a crater, had an open side, overnight went down, and it was heavier than air, didn't mix with air fast enough, came down a hillside with villages in it, and 1,800 people and lots of cattle were killed instantly in their sleep. People came back and found these dead towns. So CO2 in that kind of situation, two-step release, is probably the major hazard. And whether there's anything like that mechanism where involving the porous formations themselves, even under an earthquake situation, is something people are working on. There's a guy named Carson Proust at Lawrence Berkeley Lab in California who's really trying to figure out if he can invent a model that gives him a lot of CO2 release. It's just what people should be doing. And a lot of it right now to understand this problem.
We should probably make this the last question.
What's the problem with hydroelectric? Why is it
nothing
in all this discussion?
Well, you know, I mean, I had 20 slides with wedges. Hydro is a potential wedge. It's a lot more storage. You can do it with small dams. You can do it with big dams. Big dams have got tremendous ecological consequences. We've used a lot of storage capacity of potential already, but there's a whole world of I don't know as much of this as probably both of you do. How do you get what comes into play when you get say 700 more gigawatts of stationary hydropower?
Yeah, didn't you do
that? You know, the potential of hydro is already enormously exploited.
It is exploited, but you know there are people. I mean, some of it is for the environmentalist. The World Hydro, for me as an environmentalist, is: are there some cures that are worse than the disease? People have their eye on the Congo, the large undammed river. Africa's development would be based on damming the Congo. I don't think I want to go there, but I would have to have lots of other people under discussion. Yes, it would be a fossil fuel, free nuclear power.
The context in which Nate Lewis was saying it was maxed out was the context of, you know, if you want to get 10 terawatts from hydro, you're not going to get it. If, however, you want to get one more terawatt out of it, you could do it. But the question that Rob raises really becomes the key one. Is this a way we want to do it when you look at the whole suite of options and ask what are the wider consequences of expanding hydro that much?
Okay, maybe I could sum up and then Rosina would sum up. The wedges approach has been useful in part because it says there are a lot of options. Every one of them can be done well or badly. Instead of thinking, you can quickly persuade yourself that none of those options can do the whole job, and that isn't really, it's really a sterile exercise to go through and see that none of them can do all of it. But there are packages and alternate packages that can do the job, a combination of parallel challenges, and then really being aware of the side effects and deciding which ones you don't want. When you offer politicians multiple solutions, they're pleased. They say, okay, now I have some choices to make. And there can be choices that are made differently in different parts of the world.
Well, and I'm sure there are adaptation options for most of the impacts of climate change or things that we could do to reduce their negative impacts and help us cope better. But I think we need to get to the point where you're at with the wedges, where we can actually begin to mix and match some of these options and think about them in our particular places for particular sectors at particular time frames. And I think the task is urgent, and we best begin.
So we're in a situation of wrap-up. And I would say also acknowledgement of the salience of energy and environment when people set about to discuss the major ideas around and hard and needing discussion today. A few people in the room, including Rosina in two instances and John Holdren in a couple of instances, are the people who actually ran one or another of these events. This is my first shot at any of you. The theme of the morning is a new theme in the sense that I'm not aware of any event I've gone to in this field which has coupled two talks the way Rosina's and mine are going to be coupled today. And that's a challenge, and it's been interesting to prepare for that reason. And I realized that, well, why is this? It has to do with how the problematic of climate change has evolved in the last 5 years. The perception is, as Bill Clinton said a couple of days back, it's worse than I understood. It's worse than Clinton understood when he left office, not only because he learned more, but because the science has moved in a very definite direction. The way I put it is that a preposition has changed. The band of concentrations associated with dangerous interference, many of you people know that's a phrase in the Rio Convention, which the United States signed from 1992, dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system, is the way in which the politicians expressed the where you don't want to go in managing climate over the rest of the human experience. And it has moved, has slid downward from around twice the pre-industrial concentration to below twice the pre-industrial concentration. And I will explain what those words mean for those of few of you who don't know. But The direction has been that it's more dangerous at lower levels in the atmosphere than we thought. And one might be a postmodernist and try to understand how this might not be essential reality, but the way the forces of political forces are moving the science. But my sense is there's real science behind that slide. New measurements of various kinds. As a result, five things. The sense of urgency has increased. You hear words like jumpstart. That's a very interesting word, and it's a word I think is correct for how to think about the problem we have, as opposed to so many outputs of economic models which describe a very gradual evolution of a response to a problem. The policy focuses on reliable signals that will motivate investment. That's, again, trying in part to summarize lots of the talks we've heard already. U.S. intransigence is not a nuisance, but a menace. Karl Rove said, no, the U.S. is doing lots of good things. The U.S., and it didn't count his talk in the 15, needless to say. U.S. intransigence, he would call originality, doing the things other people aren't doing, reaching out and having a larger R&D program, reaching out to Asia. The U.S. is doing a lot of useful things. But it's like one hand clapping. And everybody understands it, except, unfortunately, he can't admit it. We don't have a policy that goes with some really important and creative innovations in technology. Rapid expansion of R&D to enable scale-up and qualitative transformation of available options. We've had a lot of discussion about what is R&D and what do we need it for and how much do we need. It's clear we need more, faster, broad gauge. But we are past, and it's only happened in the last 2 years, we are past a formulation that was coming from the administration that was so destructive or dangerous that said, we don't have anything we can do right now. I feel as if I'm one of the people who helped get rid of that piece of unfortunate rhetoric. Secretary Abraham, in a meeting I attended in May of 2004, and I'm sure he said it more than once, said we will need an invention like electricity, something completely not known at the time, in order to deal with climate change. And Steve Pakala and I wrote a paper, and there were other people getting involved in this debate from many different directions, saying that's just wrong. We already have the technologies to get going. And that debate isn't really alive anymore. And significant damage is unavoidable, I'm afraid, is another conclusion of this slide in the center of concern. Mitigation must be accompanied by adaptation, and how to balance the two is a largely unexplored question. It is that pairing of mitigation and adaptation, which we're doing today, Rosina and I, which I think is unfamiliar and challenging territory. And again, I want to hope that you'll understand by the end of this morning what that's about and why it's so hard. Now, I'm going to go back. Okay. I'm assuming many of you do not have technical backgrounds. How many of you do not have technical backgrounds in the room? Enough that I'm on the right track here. So although I'm talking quantitatively a lot, I want to say how much we need you. Here's what the next two slides are about. I'm writing an article with Steve Pakala for the September 2006 Scientific American. We're buttoning it up next week, this coming week. There will be a full-page illustration alongside the front page of text. The illustrator has been asked to capture what is at stake in dealing with climate change or not. And there hasn't been there is nothing I know that she can draw upon, that he can draw upon. There aren't a lot of images out there. So I'm going to show you, and I'm not sure what I'm violating the way of rules to do so, the first and the second draft, and we don't have a third draft, but we will by the middle of this week. Okay, and then you'll see in the journal, it's a good way to get you to buy it, what it actually says. Here's the first draft of about 3 weeks ago. Fork in the road, bucolic countryside on the right with some wind farms. One of the editors I'm working there called a Dickensian scene on the left. Altogether wrong. Back So, but we realized, well, I didn't have anything to do with even discussing the first one. When this came back, it was the first time I started thinking about, what are we talking about? Okay? No belching smokestacks, please. It's not, there will be clean technology, even if we don't solve the carbon problem. Second try. A few ideas from me and many others, from her, the people who work around Scientific American every morning, every day. Second try. Smog still, same back landscape, but now there's an emphasis on the coast. There was our, it's at the light, isn't it? Can we can a couple of lights right near the screen? They look like they're right over your head there. Just get rid of these if we could. One of those will do it. It's okay. But look, you see the, you can't, I don't want to help you see, you're good, that, well, we still got, yeah, it's better. Help you see that there's at least a beach versus a dike. Somehow nature's not under control in one case. It's going awry. More to do. But for some reason, everybody's running away in both sides down this causeway. and there's not a vehicle in sight on the right. And there's things that are still wrong, but there is, except, and there's not a public private vehicle on the right. There's this wonderful train. But everybody's fleeing. That can't be right either. So, again, if some of you have some ideas, I can still feed them in. What are we talking about? It is obviously abstract. It really isn't simple. I also want to put in, I want to ask John Holder in the front row, do you know Kitty Beer? Beer. Well, in John's hometown of Cambridge, one of his hometowns, lives Kitty Beer, who has written a novel set in 2030 called What Love Can't Do, which I just read. Anybody else ever heard of it yet? Yeah. Did you like it? It's really interesting. It's set in 2030. It's 12 short chapters. It's a family. Climate has gone awry completely. There is a migration into Canada, after which, when it's gotten large enough, the Canadians seal their southern border and call us all sorts of names, et cetera. And much, much more interesting stuff than that. I don't want to spoil it.
What is your name?
Kitty, K-I-T-T-Y, Beer, B-E-E-R. And I believe she is the Sam Beer's daughter of who taught me social science in the 1960s, if some of you know that name, who was a historian. But social scientist, I think. My classmate, actually, herself. Okay, so we have a real problem here from the beginning that we haven't even got images. But it's somehow what we're talking about is losing control of the natural environment. I think that is the essence of what we're talking about. Dangerous enough to be really scary. Odds are not clear, but they're not zero. And at what point, how much can we change the climate and get away with it? One more comment is there was a lot, I've heard a lot of questions over and over again from people saying, there must be an escape. This is volcanoes. This is something else. At some simple level, one can ask, how do you expect you can get away with manipulating the planet in the ways that we're doing and not have consequences? Do you think you want to bet on being that lucky? So this is so unfamiliar as a set of issues. They belong here at the Aspen Festival. They need the prominence they've gotten, and we have to really understand how tough it is. So I'm going to talk on mitigation. Rosina's going to talk on adaptation. I'm going to have a three-part talk. A simple model of the CO2 challenge, which is called the Wedges Model, and which Bacala and I developed and wrote in a paper in Science Magazine in 2004, and has led to this invitation of me here, and I'm glad I wrote it for that reason, if no other. And then I want to really emphasize the global nature of this problem and the importance of the developing countries and drive home just how tough it is to mitigate climate in a growing world, and the challenge to lifestyle for folks like us. So quickly, now I'm going to get numerical for a while. I'm going to ask you to focus on a single quantity, which is the rate at which we're pulling carbon atoms out of the ground as coal, oil, and gas globally. Add it all up, count it in billions of tons per year, and look at that variable, because that is the key variable of this problem, the fossil fuel extraction activity rate. And I'm going to ask you to think in 50-year clumps. And so it's a good idea to start 50 years back when we were removing from the globe, from the below the surface of this planet, carbon at a rate three times less, a bit more than three times less than we are now. And ask you to hang on to a number, which is that 7 billion tons of carbon were being pulled out, are being pulled out of the ground right now each year. 7 billion tons of carbon. So there are two questions people ask.
You're equating emissions and extraction, which implies there's no cleaning up in the process. Am I misunderstanding?
That's a very good question. I am implying equality of rate at which you take it out of the ground, rate at which it gets burned and put into the atmosphere. In the process, I am being a little fast and loose with 5 and 10% issues, changes in stock. There is carbon pulled out of the ground and put into a road, asphalt, or a roof that might not oxidize for 100 years. There is carbon going to plastics. It's under 10%. There are, of course, inventory changes, but they're small over any reasonable period of time.
But, Rob, he's thinking about scrubbers.
Scrubbers, precipitators, other means of cleaning up emissions.
Well, let me make clear, then. That's right. Okay, so I answered a different part of the question, which is there really are stock changes. But if you burn carbon dioxide, burn a fossil fuel, the carbon in that fossil fuel will be carbon dioxide very quickly. If you make carbon monoxide, it gets to carbon dioxide. The reason those smokestacks are the wrong image is because the carbon dioxide is colorless, odorless, not bothering our public health directly, and all of the carbon is becoming carbon dioxide. If it didn't become carbon dioxide at the smokestack, the atmosphere is an active chemical place, and it oxidizes this carbon dioxide.
But scrubbers don't get it. The point is today's scrubbers are removing sulfur and particulates. They're not removing the CO2. And Rob will talk later about the technical potential.
Let me make sure we get this question.
Rob, you said the bottom line is that it's fair to equate extraction.
Bottom line is it's fair to equate today. There are some ideas, and I'll be John's leading the witness. There are some ideas about that I'm very involved in personally, decoupling the generation of energy from the carbon dioxide going to the atmosphere, capturing it on its way to the atmosphere, and sending it back below ground so you get the energy without the carbon dioxide. There's so little of that going on at the present time that if I'm just focusing on the fossil fuels here, it's a fair statement to say they're about equal. But they don't have to be equal, and I'm really, in that sense, it's a really good point because I'm going to be heading that way. So, two questions are asked at this point. Very different questions, very different disciplines get involved. One of them is, if we're not particularly paying attention to carbon dioxide, as we haven't in the past, what emissions will we have from this planet 50 years from now? Okay, that's econometrics, it's crystal ball gazing, but it's people use the history of the past, development, predicted economic growth rates, population growth rates, technology innovation from various sides, competing energy technologies, estimate prices. They disagree among themselves a huge amount. Answers are all over a spread of factor of 3 or 4 for the number that would be there. What Pakal and I didn't say, I said, is, look, approximately people are saying something. I'll show you in a moment. Second question. If we really take carbon, if we take this climate problem as a brand new challenge that we have to react to, what kind of emissions can we allow 50 years from now? What do we want as a policy intervention to achieve? What do we know about the carbon system, which will give us a guidance as to how hard to work? Hard question.